per un barbiere chi tappe l'opera non si dà. La 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 bella risorsa vuol del mestiere e con la donnetta col cavaliere e con la donnetta col cavaliere e la di qualità. Tutti mi chiedono, tutti mi vogliono, donne e ragazzi, vecchie fanciulle, di quale parrucca, presto la barba, quale sanguigna, presto gli occhi, mi chiedono, mi vogliono, mi chiedono, tutti mi vogliono, quale parrucca, presto la barba, presto gli occhi, Figaro, 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 Figaro. Ahimè, ahimè, che voglia, ahimè, che folla una alla volta, per carità, per carità, per carità, una alla volta, una alla volta, per carità. E Figaro, su qua, e Figaro. Qua, figlio qua, figlio là, figlio qua, figlio su, figlio giù, figlio su, quando mettissimo sa che nel cuore resto del fagot, della città, della città, della città, della città, della città. Bravo Figaro, bravo brevissimo, bravo Figaro, bravo brevissimo, fortunatissimo, 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 per verità, bravo Figaro, bravo brevissimo, bravo Figaro, bravo brevissimo, ter fatuna, ter fatuna, ter fatuna, non mancherò, sono il fatato della città, sono il fatato della città.
You know, I never cease to be amazed by how much better stuff sounds when it's set to the right music. I mean, the words are amusing, but it's nothing just the words compared to the entire package with the music added. The depth, the feeling, the excitement is so much a function of the music and the words. This is what opera does that nothing else can. Deepen the experience so profoundly and give us cause to smile in a way that the words themselves would never do. All right. Back to the life of a hairdresser. Oh, a good life, and it's nice to meet someone who likes what he does. Now, what does this aria tell us about Figaro? He's a man of irrepressible spirit and joie de vivre. He's also very clever and street smart. We hear that in his voice. We hear that in the slickness with which he turns his phrases. And though Largo al factotum is popular and direct in melody and harmony, it is musically much more interesting and complex than anything Count Almaviva sings in this opera. Get my point? This is important. The music here is more interesting, more complex, more substantial than anything the rich and noble Count ever gets to sing. That tells us much about the characters. Last but not least, Figaro has self-knowledge. He knows who and what he is, and he likes himself. This is a perfect place for us to take our break. When we come back, we will meet in order Rosina, Dr. Bartolo, and Don Basilio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is lecture number 18, the second of a two-lecture set entitled The Bel Canto Style and Rossini's The Barber of Seville. All right, now where we left off is that Figaro has just made his entrance aria and the Count has been hidden observing who's making all this noise at dawn. And of course, he immediately recognizes his former valet. So the Count comes out of his hiding place. He and Figaro reune, shake hands, clap backs, and then after much bargaining, the Count hires Figaro to work on his behalf. Now, while the Count and Figaro are negotiating, Rosina appears on the balcony and drops a piece of paper to the duo below. On the paper is a note which Figaro reads aloud. And here's what he reads in recitative. Your constant attention has aroused my curiosity. My guardian is just leaving. As soon as he's gone, find some ingenious means to tell me your name, your rank, and your intentions. I can never appear on the balcony except in the strict company of my tyrant. Rest assured, however, that unfortunate Rosina is prepared to do anything to break her chains. Oh, the Count becomes more determined than ever to win this marvelous young lady. He sings another serenade, claiming to be a lovesick soldier named Lindoro. You see, as the Count earlier told Figaro, I don't want to tell her my name or my rank. I first want to be sure that she loves me and me alone in the world, not the wealth and the titles of Count Almaviva. So the Count is now essentially in disguise, portraying himself as a young, lovelorn soldier in the hopes that Rosina will fall in love with him, not his wealth. All right. Onward to Rosina, please. It's just a matter of time before she responds to the Count's two serenades. And when she does so, in her own entrance aria called Una Voce Poco Fa, the voice I heard just now, it is with the most sophisticated entrance aria yet. Figaro's wonderful aria notwithstanding, she, Rosina, will turn out to be the real brains of this opera. Yes, Figaro, for all his braggadocio, at one point later in the opera, turns to Rosina and says, I thought I was in control, but now I know different. And she just knowingly nods. Yes, she is the brains. All right. Rosina's entrance aria is the great cavatina, Act 1, Scene 2, Una Voce Poco Fa. A cavatina is a special brand of aria in which the music is slow and generally lyric, intended to show off a singer's line, a singer's control, to demonstrate a singer's ability to hold a long phrase with beauty of tone, nuance, and color. So it's a special kind of aria meant to show a singer's ability to hold line. Now, the piece is a wonderful example of the beautiful melody-dominated bel canto style and a wonderful example of Rossini at his very best. It begins with a striking introductory gesture in the orchestra, and I would play that for you at the piano because it tells us much about Rosina. This is Rosina's entrance aria, and she's going to try to portray herself as a shy and coquettish little girl. Why then, my friends, does it start with music that sounds like this? Dotted rhythms, very regal, frankly, very martial. Oh, this is a steel magnolia is what this is, and that very stentorian music immediately becomes coquettish. As if to say, I can be hard, but I can be very shy and quiet if I have to be. And then the next phrase is a frilly, trilly, batting eyelash phrase. And we can imagine, oh, her eyelashes batting back and forth. Yes, the opening moments impress us with Rosina's iron-willed determination to win the handsome young soldier. And also these vivacious, trilling strings tell us much about the other side of her personality. She can be coquettish, she can be seductive, lively, playful, and flirtatious. She's a most interesting young lady. Please, Listen just to this instrumental introduction, and let's be aware of the wealth of character information revealed therein. Now, Una voce poco fa is in two parts. The first part is an accompanied recitative, and the second part is a direct, harmonically simple, popular style song slash aria. What is not simple at all is the nature of the vocal line. It's ornate, it's virtuosic, it's pure bel canto. This is a young lady full of life and in control. Oh, yes, very much in control. All right, part one, the accompanied recitative. She recalls the serenade sung to her by Lindoro and quickly decides that he will be hers. The voice I heard just now has thrilled my very heart. My heart is already pierced, and it was Lindoro who hurled the dart. Yes, Lindoro shall be mine. I've sworn it, I'll succeed. My guardian won't consent, but I will sharpen my wits, and at last he will relent, and I shall be content. All right, now I would point out the extraordinary coloratura melismas. Again, I explained melisma moments ago. I do it again. A melisma is when we have many different pitches assigned to a single syllable. Every time she sings Lindoro, we hear one of these very sexy melismas. They reveal a strong-willed, romantically inclined young woman. And now we move to the orchestral introduction, light and playful, that anticipates the second part of the aria, that is, the aria itself. I am docile, I am respectful, I am obedient, sweet, and loving. I can be ruled, I can be guided. But if crossed in love, I can be a viper, and 100 tricks I shall play before they have their way. Oh, yes, this is a young lady to be reckoned with. The reprise, that is, when we come back to the same material, boasts some extraordinary bravura, that means coloratura singing. What does this aria tell us about Rosina? She is filled with life and optimism. She cannot be controlled for long. Indeed, she is in control, and that control is portrayed through this extraordinary coloratura in her voice, of which she is a complete master. Now, one note before we listen. Our performance features the sort of coloratura singing, the sort of embellishment and ornament provided here by the singer herself that would have been expected in Rossini's time. This recording is a product of the 1950s bel canto revival, which was basically the responsibility of four sopranos. Joan Sutherland, who was also known as La Stupenda, although this is not Joan Sutherland. Maria Callas, this is not Maria Callas. Beverly Sills, this is not Beverly Sills. And Roberta Peters. Let's listen. Thank you. That's the sort of number that is guaranteed to bring the house down. Bravissima, we cry. And what you folks who are listening or even viewing this can see is that while this was playing, the studio audience and even the camera people started grooving to this music because it's clear, direct, and to the point. It's good pop music with a dance beat, and it's impossible not to move to it. But it's also highly embellished coloratura, and I trust we heard that as well. Now, singers in the bel canto era were expected to ornament and embellish their arias, but we have to be careful the degree to which they're allowed to do that. Now, Rossini went so far as to write out many such ornaments and embellishments in the hopes of heading off tasteless displays on the parts of his singers, but he was only moderately successful in that. Years after his retirement, Rossini accompanied a young Adelina Patti, a very famous soprano of the day, in a performance of Una Voce Poco Fa. She apparently recognized the piece completely she embellished the piece out of recognition. After congratulating her on her singing, Rossini sarcastically inquired as to who the composer was. Yes, indeed. Rossini once told French composer Camille Saint-Saëns that he did not mind having his arias embellished, and now I quote Rossini, "They were made for that, but to leave not a note of what I composed, well, that's really too much." Eric Plaut tells us, "The bel canto era ushered in the reign of the soprano superstar, the prima donna, which, except for the occasional appearance of superstar tenors, has continued to the present day. Great sopranos like Patti, Catalani, Colbrand, Pasta, Negri, Malibrand, Viardot, and Grisi became more than just superstars. They became divas, goddesses. Not only did they attain great renown, riches, and adulation, they also won immense control over the world of opera. Composers, conductors, producers, and impresarios had to defer to their every whim. And this had also been true of the superstar Castrati. Catalani's 1826 contract read as follows, quote, Madame Catalani shall choose and direct the operas in which she is to sing. She shall likewise have the choice of the performers in them. She will have no orders to receive from anyone, and she will find all her own dresses, unquote. The bel canto divas' demands for autonomy were exceeded only by their demands for money. They were unique, and they knew it, and they charged not just what traffic could bear, but not infrequently more than that. Impresarios were often faced with a Hobson's choice, either pay the fee and go broke, or refuse and watch their competitor hire that diva and lose their audience and go broke anyway. It was the diva and the diva alone who people came to hear. In the 1820s, a good meal could be had for 10 cents, a ticket to the opera for 50 cents. A house servant received $30 a year, plus room and board, an orchestra player, $200 a year. At the same time, Catalani, a Pasta, a Malibran could command fees of more than $500 a performance. The great Castrati of the previous century had demanded similar fees, but what was remarkable about the bel canto divas is that nowhere else in the 19th century world could women earn anything except small amounts from menial labor. Divas were treated like goddesses, and as such were exempt from many of the constraints other women faced, and their behavior was often highly unconstrained. Lavish lifestyles and promiscuity were not uncommon. Adulation has throughout history gone to the heads of superstars. Few have been able to resist the siren call of being free of ordinary social constraints. The social constraints of the 19th century on women were extraordinary. It was a rare woman who did not indulge herself when freed from them. Onward, please, to Dr. Bartolo. Figaro described Dr. Bartolo this way to the Count. Why, he's a miserly old devil, suspicious, crabbed. He must be 100, but he wants to play the gallant. And just imagine, so as to enjoy Rosina's entire legacy, he's taken it into his head to marry her. Help! Eventually, Dr. Bartolo comes to suspect that Rosina is passing notes to Count Almaviva, who Bartolo now knows is the secret admirer of his ward. In dry recitative, Bartolo interrogates Rosina. Bartolo says, And did Figaro bring you a reply to your note?
What note?
Oh, what's the use? That which you dropped this morning from the balcony. You're blushing, eh? If only I had guessed. What is the meaning, and he seizes Rosina's finger, of your ink-stained finger?
Stained? Oh, nothing. I burned myself, and I used the ink as medicine.
Uh-huh. Look, the evidence linking Rosina to a secret correspondence is going to mount, and she's going to do her best to lie her way out. Bartolo. Oh, the devil, sure. He counts the sheets of paper on the table. These sheets of paper, there are five now, there were six.
The notepaper, you're right. I used one to wrap the sweets I sent to Marcellina.
Oh, bravissimo. He picks up the pen. And the pen, why is the pen sharpened?
Rosina thinks, heavens, the pen. Oh, yes, to draw a flower to embroider.
A flower?
A flower.
A flower? Oh, you minx.
It's the truth.
Silence. Believe me. Enough of this.
Sir.
No more. Be quiet.
Bartolo has heard enough. One of the great comic arias follows.
A un dottor della mia sorte.
For a doctor of my standing, these excuses, signorina, I advise you, my dear child, to invent a little better, 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 better.
Meglio, 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 meglio.
Ah, he's browbeating her like a child.
Sweets for Marcellina, a design for your embroidery, and the scalding of your finger?
Oh, it takes more than that, my girl, to deceive me with success.
More, 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 more. Altro, 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 altro.
Yes, the pompous and heavy dotted rhythms ably describe our aging pedant. Note the patronizing and pedantic tone with which he addresses Rosina, particularly in these marvelous repeats of meglio and altro. All right, in short, huffing and puffing phrases mimicked by the orchestra, Bartolo becomes aware that the problem with Rosina might be greater than he thought.
Why is that sheet of paper missing? I mean to find out what's going on. No, coaxing is useless. Keep away. Don't touch me. No, my dear girl, give up all hope that I'll let myself be fooled. For a doctor of my standing, these excuses, Signorina, I advise you, my dear child, to invent a little better. Now come, dear child, confess it all. I'm prepared to pardon you. You don't answer? You are stubborn? Then I know well what I'll do.
Yes, I'm not getting through to her, am I? Bartolo's frustration absolutely boils over in an extraordinary patter section. His tone ranges from anger to sarcasm as he metes out punishment for Rosina's obstinance.
Signorina, another time when Bartolo must leave the house, he'll give orders to the servants who see that you stay inside. Now, your pouting will not help you, nor your injured innocence. I assure you, through that door, the very air will not enter.
And little innocent Rosina, disconsolate and despair, now your pouting will not help you, nor your injured innocence. Here, I assure you, through the door, the very air won't enter. And little innocent Rosina, disconsolate and in despair, in her chamber shall be locked for as long as I see fit.
All right, Bartolo attempts to gather up what is left of his dignity and returns to a more measured tone.
For a doctor of my standing does not let himself be fooled.
Never has the generation gap been better described in music. Please, while you listen, ask yourself, what does this aria tell us about Bartolo?
A un dottor della mia sorte queste scuse, signorina. A un dottor della mia sorte queste scuse, signorina. Vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in postura. Meglio. Vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in postura. Meglio. Vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in postura. Sì. Vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in postura. Un dottor della mia sorte queste scuse, signorina. Vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in postura. Ricano sul tamburo, vi scotaste e via, ci vola altro, figlia mia, per potermi corbellar, altro, ci vola altro, figlia mia, per potermi corbellar, altro, perché manca da quel foglio, non saper con esso imbroglio, perché manca da quel foglio, sono inutile sporchie, per malvo non mi tocco. Signorina, vi consiglio, mia carina, un po' meglio in posto. Non parlate, vi
ostinate, non parlate, vi ostinate, so io quel che ho da far, so io quel che ho da far.
Signorino, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori. Signorino, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, la consegna servitoria al suo modo lo saprà. Signorino, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori. Signorino, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, la consegna servitoria al suo modo lo saprà. E non se ve non le smorfie, faccia pure la gatta morta, faccia pure la gatta morta. Cospetto per quella porta, cospetto perché la porta di mellare dopo tro. E Rosina innocentina, sconsolata, disperata, e non se vengono le smorfie, facci pure la gatta morta, tu aspetta per quella porta, dimmi la tua porta, e non sono lo sentine, non se ne non sono lo sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, sì, 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 sì. Signore, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, signore, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, la tua sei servitore, il suo modo la saprà. Signore, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, signore, un'altra volta quando va a tornare fuori, la consegna servitore, il suo modo la saprà. E non se vanno le smorfie, faccia pure la gatta morta, faccia pure la gatta morta. Cospetto per quella porta, cospetto per quella porta, di mellare, tu potrà. Cospetto per quella porta, di mellare, tu potrà. E Rosina innocentina, sconsolata, disperata, e non servono le smorfie, faccia pure la gatta morta. Cospetto per quella porta, di mellare, tu potrà. E Rosina innocentina, Rosina innocentina, sconsolata, disperata, sconsolata, disperata, in sua camera serata, in sua camera serata, in sua camera serata, perché ora sono un dator della mia sorte, non si lascia infino chiamar, no, no. Un dator della mia sorte, non si lascia infino chiamar. Di Rosina innocentina, sconsolata, disperata, in sua camera serrata, io voglio star un po', io voglio star un po'.
Yes, what does this aria tell us about Dr. Bartolo? Well, pretty much everything we need to know. He's a pompous, condescending, blowhard, and Rosina is completely unafraid of him. Now, the other character we will meet is Don Basilio. He is the friend and aide-de-camp to Dr. Bartolo. He's described this way by Figaro. Basilio is a famous, intriguing matchmaker, a hypocrite, a good-for-nothing with never a penny in his pocket. He has lately turned music maker and teaches this girl. Basilio has come up with a solution for dealing with the troublesome Count Almaviva. Basilio's specialty is slander. Basilio tells Dr. Bartolo, just this, that plausibly we must begin to invent a story which will put him in a bad light with the public, making him seem a man of infamy, a doomed soul. I shall attend to this within 4 days on the word of Basilio. He'll be thrown out of town. Yes, he suggests that they immobilize the Count by discrediting him. Basilio is to Bartolo, my friends, what Figaro is to the Count. Lucky for the Count, Figaro will easily outclass Basilio. In his superbly comic aria, La calunnia è un venticello, slander is a little breeze, Basilio describes the process. Slander is a little breeze, a gentle zephyr, which insensibly, subtly, lightly, and sweetly commences to whisper. Quiet orchestral whispers imitate the slander. Note these nagging, slanderous violas.
Softly, softly, here and there, sotto voce, sibilant, it goes gliding, it goes rambling. Into the ears of the people it penetrates slyly, and the head and the brains it stuns and swells. And ever so slowly, another crescendo begins to build up. From the mouth reemerging, the noise grows crescendo, gathers force little by little, runs its course from place to place, seems the thunder of the tempest from which the depths of the forest comes whistling, muttering, freezing everyone in horror. Finally, with crack and crash, it spreads afield, its force redoubled, and produces an explosion, like the outburst of a cannon, an earthquake, a whirlwind, a general uproar, which makes the air resound. Indeed, we hear a huge explosion. The cannon shot is imitated by a fortissimo bass drum, and then in a move of great comedic timing, the voice again withdraws to an almost sympathetic quietude as it describes the damage done by the slander. Tisk, tisk. And the poor slandered wretch, vilified, trampled down, sunk beneath the public lash, by good fortune, falls to death. It's a brilliant aria for basso, and it is both a comic caricature of the Baroque-style simile aria, as well as another example of Rossini's use of crescendo. Let's listen to this aria, at least up to the first cannon shot, and then we must move on. And we're near enough the end that I could say we've heard the great body of this aria, but move on we must. Now, what does this aria tell us about Don Basilio? Well, first of all, he makes Dr. Bartolo look like a combination of Will Rogers and Mother Teresa. Basilio is a sneaky, nasty sleaze.
He'd be a perfect tabloid reporter, or perhaps the host of a daytime talk show. An important point to make before I move on. Rossini's characters, the Count, Figaro, Rossina, Dr. Bartolo, Don Basilio, are all great fun, but they lack the complexity, the depth, the humanity of Mozart's Count, Figaro, Rossina, Bartolo, and Basilio. This is because Mozart's music, with its inexhaustible wealth of harmonic and melodic detail and shading, its subtle contrasts and formal complexity, imbues his characters with an equal amount of subtlety, with varying moods, and with great dramatic flexibility. Mozart's music makes his characters fully and completely human, where Rossini's characters are comic cardboard cutouts, wonderfully funny, but caricatures of real people. Might I suggest that Mozart's Marriage of Figaro be likened to a Woody Allen movie, a comedy filled with genuine human angst and irony, which celebrates the strengths and weaknesses of the human animal and the very nature of the human condition, a movie which is incidentally funny. Rossini's The Barber of Seville is like a Marx Brothers or a Mel Brooks movie, quick and comic, with no pretense to be anything else. Obviously, Rossini's comedy is much more typical of the buffa tradition than Mozart's. All right, and quickly, we have a little time, so we're going to listen to a little of the Act Two music lesson. The Count, disguised as a music teacher, gains entry into Dr. Bartolo's house. He tells Bartolo that Don Basilio, Rossina's regular music teacher, is ill, and he's come in his place. Bartolo calls Rosina downstairs for her music lesson. Rossina, for her part, immediately recognizes her beloved Lindoro. The lesson commences with Rossina singing an incredibly ornate aria, and we will pick up just in the cadenza of that aria in the bel canto style. Bartolo, true to form, falls asleep in an armchair while listening to her sing her modern bel canto aria. The Count, disguised as Don Alonso, says, "A beautiful voice, bravissima," and Rossina says, "Oh, mille grazie, a thousand thanks." Bartolo, waking up and crossing to the keyboard, "Yes, yes, truly a beautiful voice, but this aria, damnation, it's rather tiresome. Music in my day was quite another thing. Ah, when, for instance, Caffariello, a famous castrato, sang that wonderful aria, la, 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 la. Listen, Don Alonso, here it is." And now, and it's a wonderful bit of comic timing, Bartolo sings a minuet, clearly a piece of music from the opera seria tradition, not too distant in the past in 1816. This is a devastating little satire on opera seria, and the old man Bartolo is its vehicle. "When you are near me, sweet Rossina," and the Count interrupts, "the aria says Giannina." And Bartolo says, "Yes, the aria says Giannina, but I say Rossina. When you are near me, sweet Rossina, my heart glows in my breast. It dances a minuet." Let's hear this little bit of nostalgia and then move on to wrap up this lecture.
Ma quest'aria cospetto è assai noiosa. La musica ai miei tempi è un'altra cosa. A quando per esempio cantava Gaffariello quell'aria portentosa. Tremolo, tremolo, Allora, allora, sentite, Don Alonso, eccola qua.
Dice Giannina, ma io dico Rosina.
And this is one of the most typical devices of all comic opera, to imitate serious opera. It's a wonderful scene, but we must cut it short as we move to the concluding statements. Donald Grout wrote on Rossini and melody. Very few composers have equaled Rossini in rhythmic élan and sheer tunefulness. It's difficult to analyze the patent charms of these apparently effortless, seemingly artless Rossinian melodies that well forth in a ceaseless stream from his operas. Held within the frame of a persistent rhythmic pattern, cast in short, regular phrases of narrow range, which are often immediately repeated, crystal clear in their harmonic implications, they seem to gather up the whole Italian national genius for pure vocal melody as the elemental mode of musical expression. Rossini recalls a visit to Beethoven in 1822, 6 years after composing The Barber of Seville, and the advice that Beethoven gave him. Rossini recounts, "I mounted the stairs leading to the poor lodgings of the great man. I found myself in a sort of attic, terribly disordered and dirty. I particularly remember the ceiling. It was under the roof and showed crevices through which the rain must have poured down. When we entered, he paid no attention to us, but remained bent over the music he was finishing. Then, raising his head, he said in reasonably comprehensible Italian, 'Ah, Rossini, you are the composer of Barber of Seville? My congratulations, that is an excellent opera buffa. I have read it with pleasure, and I enjoyed myself. It will be played so long as Italian opera will exist. Never, never try your hand at anything but opera buffa.' Our visit was short. One side of the conversation had to be conducted in writing. I expressed to him all my admiration of his genius. He answered with a deep sigh and the single phrase, 'Oh, un felice, I am a wretch.' Then, wishing me success with my next opera, he rose and showed me out with the remark, 'Above all, do a lot more of The Barber.' When I descended those dilapidated stairs, I could not repress my tears." Beethoven's advice be damned. Rossini did compose increasingly grand and serious operas. The 19th century, the Romantic era, was a grand and serious and heroically tragic age. By the 1830s, opera buffa was no longer the preeminent genre of new opera, having been replaced by so-called grand opera or 19th century opera seria. David Kimball tells us, while Rossini's serious operas were slowly superseded in public favor by Bellini and Donizetti in the 1830s and Verdi in the 1840s, his comic operas remained unsurpassed, peerless models of a style which any composer who wished to essay the buffa genre had to imitate. Their continued popularity in the theater is charmingly testified to by the librettist Felice Romani, and now I quote Romani. Rossini's buffet fill the coffers of all the impresarios in the peninsula. They exhilarate the ponderous Germans, inflame the frigid Britons, and make even the pensive Quakers of Pennsylvania dance with joy." Unquote. "My immortality," said Rossini upon being asked, "do you know what will survive me? The third act of William Tell, the second act of my Otello, and of course the Barber of Seville, from one end to the other." A harsh judgment. We remember Rossini for much more, but The Barber of Seville is 19th century opera buffa and bel canto at its very best. So, mille grazie to you, Signor Rossini. Onward to Giuseppe Verdi. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 19, the first of a four-lecture set entitled Giuseppe Verdi and Otello. My friends, who were these guys? Sampieri, Mancini, Ricci, Monti, Petrella, Morales, Vera, Montuoro, Marchetti, Parelli, Vezzosi, Battista, Germano, Alberto, Seneca, Zecchini, Tencioni, Libani, and Grondona? Well, they were all composers of Italian opera with premieres in the year 1869, the same year as Verdi's Don Carlo, 2 years before Verdi's Aida. Who were they and what their operas were outside of Italy? Who knows? Indeed, the career of Giuseppe Verdi practically constitutes the history of Italian opera from 1850 to 1900. For 50 years, Verdi not just dominates, but lords over completely the world of Italian opera. Giuseppe Verdi, October 1813 to January 1901. He wrote 26 operas. He began his first at the age of 20 in 1833, and that was the opera Oberto. He completed his last opera in 1893, Falstaff, at the age of 80, a 60-year opera career. A most important point that has to be made right at the onset: Verdi was not a purposeful innovator or an operatic reformer. At no point did Verdi purposely break with his past or experiment radically with new operatic theories. His evolution was towards refinement of dramatic content, towards refinement of technique, and in the end, of course, he brought Italian opera to a pinnacle that has never been surpassed. Verdi's aim then was always towards refinement and intensification of dramatic line, singing technique, literary and emotional truth. A brief but I hope telling biography. He was born on October 10 of 1813 in Le Roncole in Parma. He had a middle-class upbringing, and he showed a moderate degree of musical talent early. He studied with various local organists. Ultimately, his musical education was underwritten by a rich local merchant by the name of Antonio Barezzi. It's an important name, so I would repeat it. Antonio Barezzi. He was from the nearby city of Busseto. At Barezzi's expense, Verdi journeyed at the age of 18 to Milan to attend the Milan Conservatory of Music. He was a short, intense, taciturn person, Verdi was, with brown hair, black eyebrows and beard, a very pale complexion, and a pockmarked face. To Verdi's great surprise and disappointment, and I suppose we should add humiliation, he was not granted admission to the Milan Conservatory. His piano playing and keyboard skills were considered too weak, and his knowledge of music theory was considered completely inadequate. Nevertheless, Verdi remained in Milan for 2 years, studying privately, and even began work on what would be his first opera, Oberto. He returned to Busseto at the age of 20 in 1833, and he married Antonio Barezzi's daughter, Margarita. Now, this is a very nice sponsor. He not only pays for Verdi's education, but gives of his daughter as well. Oberto is eventually completed, and it comes to the attention of the director of the La Scala, the great opera house of Milan, a gentleman named Bartolomeo Morelli. To his eternal credit, Morelli took a chance on an opera by an unknown composer and was rewarded when Oberto was well received. In one of those far-sighted moves for which we must be grateful, Morelli offered Verdi a contract to compose three new operas at eight-month intervals. The first opera of this La Scala commission was Un Giorno di Regno, King for a Day, an opera buffa. Now, it was during this exact period of his life that a series of horrific tragedies strike Verdi and his family. I would outline them quickly. They are very painful just to talk about. In August of 1838, Verdi's 16-month-old daughter, Virginia, dies suddenly. 14 months later, October 1839, his 18-month-old son, Icilio, who had been 4 months old when his sister died, dies of bronchial pneumonia. Verdi wrote 40 years later, he wrote in 1879, and I quote Verdi, "The poor little boy, languishing, died in the arms of his utterly desolate mother," unquote. 8 months later, June 1840, stricken with what was called rheumatic fever, but what we would now call encephalitis, Margherita Verdi dies after a 5 or 6 day illness. In 22 months, Verdi loses his son, his daughter, and his wife to various illnesses. Giuseppe Damaldè, a friend of Verdi's, described him as being so severely depressed that, and I quote, "his profound sorrow led him to give up everything completely and forever. He thought of nothing but hiding himself in some dark place and living out his miserable existence." Verdi, distraught with grief, incredibly completed the remainder of the comic opera Un Giorno del Regno. King for a Day was premiered 3 months after Margherita's death on September 5th of 1840. Do we have to be told that Un Giorno del Regno was a complete disaster, an utter failure? Under these circumstances, how could Verdi have written anything yet a comedy? Verdi wrote years later, "Certainly some